Hello, I'm Keith Parent, and welcome to Focus Asia Pacific from PCJ Radio International. On today's program, China and Russia fail to sign an important gas deal. Will the new microblog rules passed by Beijing have any impact? The United Nations is calling for nearly $200 million to help North Korea's humanitarian needs. We have this and much more on this edition of Focus Asia Pacific, putting the focus on the Asia Pacific. The failure of Russia and China to sign a big gas deal supply contract last week has revived talk of the competitive tension between the two neighbors. The two have argued for years over the final price for the sale of billions of cubic meters of Russian gas to China via two Siberian pipelines. The former Cold War rivals have undoubtedly grown closer in the past decade, evident in their common position on Syria, much increased trade and frequent trips to China by Russian President Vladimir Putin. But Raffaello Pantucci from the Shanghai Academy of Social Sciences says even the apparent harmony of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization last week hid underlining tensions. Russia and China are the dominant members of the six-member group, which includes four former Soviet states, including Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, Tajikistan, and Uzbekistan. He speaks next with Karen Snowden.
From my perspective, if you look at the sort of long-term strategic objectives and the long-term interests that, you know, the Chinese and the Russians are advancing in the SCO and in Central Asia more broadly, there is a sort of direct clash, and it's sort of unavoidable to reach this conclusion. There is this vision at the moment of China and Russia being in sort of great concord in the world because we see them doing a lot of things together in the Security Council. And to some degree, their sort of global outlooks are similar. But I think it would be an exaggeration to say that this is some sort of partnership across the board where they agree on everything. I think within Central Asia and within sort of a lot of bilateral things to do with energy and in some investment questions as well, and, you know, migration of Russian, of Chinese citizens into Russia, there is, in fact, a pretty high level of tension to be found between the two.
And is it the case of two big powers butting heads? We're looking at Central Asia in this case. Do their interests clash there in that region, that which butts both of them geographically, of course?
Well, I mean, in Central Asia, it's a case of Russia sees the region as its sort of domain still, to some degree. They have clearly strong economic and other interests there, and they can see that the Chinese are quite steadily making progress into the region. Now, I don't overstate it and say that the Chinese have sort of taken over the region, but if you look at countries like Kyrgyzstan in particular, or Kazakhstan, you can see Chinese influence is very high and getting higher. And you can see that the economic interests are all veering in China's direction. And the Russians see this, and they see this area as their former, as their sphere of influence, and are concerned about this sort of Russia, this growing Chinese presence and influence there.
And is it focus, is China's growing interest and focus in Central Asia primarily to do with energy and energy security?
Well, in fact, if we think about China's interest in Central Asia, we really need to realize, we need to pay attention to the province of China that abuts Central Asia, Xinjiang. Xinjiang is one of China's biggest provinces. It's also traditionally one of its poorest provinces, and it has all sorts of ethnic tensions. And it's very underdeveloped. And so the Chinese see their investments in Central Asia are really part of a strategy to try to develop the periphery around Xinjiang. The idea being that then you can sort of help develop Xinjiang, you know, in, through this. By developing the region around it, then Xinjiang has more places it can trade with, and you can have a more stable region. You don't have to worry so much about security and stability spilling across the border. So, I mean, it's really what, when one thinks about China and Central Asia, it's more useful to focus on Xinjiang and to think about how the policy towards it is really towards developing Xinjiang.
And
it is also, of course, towards helping open up for Chinese goods to get to Europe and then to ports in Iran and Pakistan.
And Pakistan.
Yes.
And certainly not all four members, those Central Asian states of the Shanghai group, are entirely comfortable with the attentions of China.
Well, no, because they worry about, you know, over-dependence on one over the other. Now, previously, their economies were tightly tied into Russia, and they still are to a very high degree. However, you know, they're not that eager to trade this up for the same sort of relationship with China. So they try to advance these policies of sort of what they call multi-vector diplomacy, the idea being that you sort of balance the powers off each other and sort of use your leverage as the guy in between to advance your interests. And this has worked to sort of varying degrees in different countries, to be honest. And there are different levels of sort of tension towards the Chinese to be found in the four SCO members from Central Asia.
China operates the most extensive internet censorship system on the planet. There is a constant tug of war between users who want freedom of expression and the government, which tries to control that expression. Social media sites like Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube are all blocked by the country. But it has its own social media site called Sina Weibo. The microblogging service has recently introduced users a code of conduct for its 300 million members. The new rules ban for illegal protests or flash mobs, personal attacks, or threats to China's honor. The move comes after Chinese authorities ordered Weibo to ensure all members register their real identities. Ali Benton speaks to Jeremy Goldcorn, a blogger and founder of Danway.com.
In recent years, there's been an unprecedented flowering of free expression on the Chinese internet. One of the big factors, the popularity of micro-blogging site Sina Weibo, China's Twitter equivalent. The site has 300 million users and has become a platform for the exchange of opinions, views and news. Last week, the site introduced a code of conduct, explicitly restricting the types of messages that can be posted. Jeremy Goldcorn, founder of Danway.com.
Well, this is the latest attempt by Sina to, you know, put in place some kind of system to control its users. Last year, the news was that they were going to implement a real name registration system, which would require people to register with their real identities. That system has not, in fact, been implemented. Whether this new system will have any effect on users is still an open question. So my take on it is it's an attempt by Sina to make sure its users know that they're being watched. It's an attempt by Sina to show the government that they are trying to take action to control some of the discussion on their platform. How effective it will be remains to be seen, and I don't see it as likely to severely alter the shape of the conversation on Weibo.
Jeremy Goldcorn has lived in Beijing since 1995. He's monitored the development of blogging sites like Weibo and says they have completely changed the media landscape in China.
Stories and photos of things going on all over the country are now very easily accessible and, moreover, very easy to share. People who were previously voiceless, people in, you know, small towns, now have at least a shot at having their voice heard. If the problem touches on something that the central government considers extremely sensitive, it will probably still be censored, and it may not be heard. But there are dozens and dozens of cases where people have had a problem and have used Weibo to expose the problem and seek justice. That's a very big difference. It's also meant that there's a lot of controversial and political commentary available very easily to anybody with an internet connection. The kind of commentary that one still doesn't see in the traditional media, and that has changed the intellectual landscape of China quite significantly, I think.
China has had its fair share of political scandals in recent months. The case of the deposed Chinese Communist leader Bo Xilai, possibly the biggest news story in China. Was there an attempt from Chinese officials to clamp down on debate around that scandal?
Yes, indeed there was. They did and have, and to this day there are still various keyword filters in place making it difficult to either post or search for information about the scandal. nonetheless, the news first got out because somebody posted photos of the former police chief of Chongqing City, who apparently tried to seek asylum in the U.S. consulate in Chengdu. The news first got out because people were posting photos of the area around the consulate and a large police presence there. That's how the story got out. And in previous years, perhaps this whole affair would have remained behind closed doors and nobody would be any the wiser. But in the age of Weibo, it was impossible to contain it.
Chinese internet users have become particularly savvy in the way they get around censorship. Using nicknames for public figures is very common. The word Teletubby, for example, is code for China's premier, Wen Jiabao.
One example from the Bo Xilai affair was Bo's surname is a homophone of a word that means thin. So people were talking about Mr. Not Thick as a way of getting around the censorship of his surname. People also upload text as an image, which makes it more difficult to search and find and delete. So they'll turn an essay or an article into a JPEG image and upload that instead of uploading the text. And there's a very bawdy and vibrant kind of sense of humor on the Chinese internet. So you see a lot of cartoons and comics about sensitive issues. And those, again, are more difficult to censor because there's no text necessarily associated with them.
News travels quicker, obviously, on a micro-blogging site, but there's also been cases of false news circulating on this site. Is that a concern for Chinese authorities?
Oh, yeah, it's a big concern. And that's, in fact, most of the propaganda effort around the control of the internet and Weibo in particular has focused on a campaign against online rumors. You know, from my own point of view, the government tends to exaggerate the negative effects of online rumors and use it as an excuse for the censorship of political speech. But there are certainly a lot of untruths that are circulated online in China, just like anywhere else.
That was Jeremy Goldcorn, a blogger and founder of Danway.com, speaking to Ali Benton. You're listening to Focus Asia Pacific. The United Nations is calling for $198 million in aid to meet the humanitarian needs of North Korea this year. The UN says 16 million North Koreans continue to suffer from chronic food insecurity, high rates of malnutrition, and deep-rooted economic problems. It has presented its overview for funding to the international donor community in Beijing. Anna Hipsley speaks to the UN resident coordinator for North Korea, Jerome Savage. That was the UN resident coordinator for North Korea, Jerome Savage, speaking with Anna Hipsley.
The key needs that we see for the moment is availability of food, need for nutrition and health support for the most vulnerable parts of the population, but also addressing the more chronic problems in agriculture.
Like what?
Like what chronic problem? Lack of irrigation, lack of mechanization, basically not enough input to support the agriculture and to make North Korea able to produce enough food for its population.
So it's not just about feeding people, it's about getting the infrastructure there to help them feed themselves.
Exactly. We feel that providing food is important, but if we could get this agriculture stronger, less susceptible to suffer from the shocks of weather in particular.
How can you ensure that the money that is given will go to the people that need it most and not to the North Korean regime?
Well, this is always a very big concern of all of our donors, and we're very careful with that. And if you're an agency on the ground, you are able to negotiate better operating conditions. We feel like last year was actually the year when we got the best set of access conditions and access to monitoring of our program and a whole series of conditions gave us for the first time most access to markets so we can verify the food situation. And we had Korean speakers on the ground, and we could also have a short notice to go into the counties to see what the real situation was. So, you know, in every country, delivering food and delivering assistance is an issue. It is over there too, so we are aware that we need to really show the best possible situation for the donors.
Are you able to bring food in, or are you essentially using the money to buy food off the regime?
Most of the food, all of the food is being brought from the outside.
So you were talking there about a shortfall the money that you didn't get last year, and so you couldn't meet the needs really of the population. How much is that down to people, the reluctance of countries to provide aid given the situation with the regime? Or is that something to do as well with the global financial crisis and the fact that many countries actually don't have the money to spare?
Well, you know, no appeal for humanitarian assistance is always 100% funded. You always find a gap between what we're asking for and what we really get in the end. So this gap, for the moment, we're already 38% funded for the year. We certainly hope that we're going to do better than this. Our hope is that we can provide more assistance. Basically, what happens is if you don't get all the assistance that you've been requesting, you have to make choices. Last year, for example, in food distribution, a certain group that we had identified for needing assistance, like the elderly, did not receive the WFP's food support.
That must be incredibly difficult, basically deciding who gets to eat and who doesn't.
It's very difficult. Last time, UNICEF, working in a number of counties, had identified very severe malnutrition in 25 counties in particular. Now, they knew that there were other counties where they would need to get really quickly bring food and mostly nutrition assistance, like plumpy nuts, which is basically medicine, to these children. And choices had to be made, and not every country was covered.
Japan could begin generating nuclear energy again as soon as next week. The Japanese Prime Minister this week will continue to push the idea of restarting two of the country's 50 reactors before the summer heat wave kicks in. But it's not just voters the Prime Minister is worried about, with warnings that the erratic power supply could damage Japan's already fragile economy. Bill Bainbridge has more.
The public doesn't like it, but in the end, they may not be able to do without it, at least in the short term. When Prime Minister Yoshihiko Noda announced his desire to restart the reactors at the Ohi plant, he did so with a plea for understanding. While the public opinion is polarized, he said, I take full responsibility. I cannot put people's safety and livelihood at stake by not restarting the nuclear reactors. I ask for the nation's understanding that this is a decision based on trying to protect the people. All 50 of the country's plants are currently closed for safety checks and because local governments are resisting their reopening. But modelling by the Institute of Energy Economics of Japan shows that without the two reactors, the country will face an electricity gap of more than 7% from peak demand this summer. The manager of the IEEJ's nuclear energy group is Tomoko Murakami.
Now limited to this summer, we might be able to survive without nuclear.
But that depends on delivering a 12% energy saving across the country and would add to the huge cost of importing gas and oil.
We have calculated the additional cost for importing additional gas and oil would be 3 or 4 trillion yen per year.
That's around $40 to $50 billion a year. Henry Trix is Tokyo Bureau Chief for The Economist. He says some of the doomsaying scenarios need to be treated with scepticism.
The main economic think tanks in Japan are heavily sponsored by the electricity industry. So the numbers tend to be slightly dubious.
Nonetheless, he says the government is carefully preparing the ground for restarting the reactors.
The risk, of course, is that this summer, when temperatures rise in July and August, the country will start to suffer the same sort of electricity shortages that it faced last summer, immediately after the Fukushima disaster. And the government is arguing now increasingly strongly that Japan cannot survive without nuclear power, and in fact that some of its most significant industrial centres will be squeezed if it doesn't turn the reactors back on.
And he says it's not just a case of Japanese industry enduring an unprofitable summer.
The bigger risk economically is that the more unstable the power supply is in Japan, the more companies think about moving their production offshore. And what with a very high yen, this is becoming an increasing risk for Japan's economy, and that's a long-term risk as well.
But while in the short term the government is trying to convince the public of the need to restart reactors, over the longer term they're modelling more options. Three set to be put out for public consultation include reducing nuclear from its pre-Fukushima 30% of Japan's energy mix down to either 25%, 15% or even 0% by the year 2030. Natural gas looks to be the most likely option to fill the energy hole, but Japan is also looking to catch up on renewable energy. Next month, the government will introduce a generous subsidy for renewable energy via a so-called feed-in tariff in an attempt to encourage alternative energy, which currently only generates about 1% of power.
Because of its fetishization of nuclear power, it had always underinvested in alternative energy, in solar, in geothermal, in wind. And although it's considered likely to take quite a long time, maybe, you know, 10 or 20 years before some of these alternative technologies are sufficiently developed in Japan to be able to make a meaningful contribution to the energy supply, there is a sense here, I think, that just having Japanese engineers thinking about these forms of energy is a good thing. It's likely to make development of things like solar power and wind power and geothermal happen much quicker, because Japan is a very strong engineering country.
In East Timor, where there are about two-thirds of the population are under the age of 20, education is a major preoccupation. Most public, primary, and secondary schools are overcrowded, often with underqualified teachers. But as East Timor attempts to develop its economy and attract foreign investment, much of the concern centers on the lack of level entry opportunities. Here's reporter Helen Hoffman.
This is Universidad Nacional de Timor-Leste, or UNTEL, East Timor's only public university. UNTEL is a relatively small institution, but it has big ambitions.
This is the strategic plan for 2011-2020 with a vision, mission, and then the main...
That's Francisco Miguel Martins, who has worked with the university since it was established in 1986. He's now a vice rector of the newly established Postgraduate and Research Affairs Department.
So a university is a central to form or to educate the people in a high-level education to improve, to upgrade their quality in all areas of study, that to benefit for this country, to participate in the in development of this country.
But with an annual budget of just $6 million, UNTEL faces some major challenges.
My name is Eletra Costa, and I'm studying chemistry facility of my laboratory, which is not, it's a very basic. My laboratory is so small, but every time we take time to practice, doing some practices, the student more than 100. It's difficult to see the experiment.
My name is Victor Da Costa. I also study in this university, and I take a faculty agriculture facility. And here, this university, it's not complex. I try to get chairs and do books. Also, don't have any internet in here, so it's very difficult for me to access the other experience, especially for my faculty.
And for the teachers, the conditions are difficult too. Dozens of students are cramped into small, hot classrooms. The library facilities are limited, and there are only a few computer terminals. All of this makes it a challenge to attract good teachers, but also to keep the best students from going overseas.
My name is Cristóbal Reis. I'm Dean of Economics and Management
at UNTEL. Based on experience, many students, they like to study at National University of Timor-Leste because public university and fee is low. Compared with private universities, fee is high and then sometimes then low quality.
Do you still lose many of the very best students to universities in Indonesia, Australia, or other places?
Yes, we are still need to improve because we have limited equipments.
So that's facilities, but the quality of the teaching, the quality of
quality
the work?
Of the teaching, yes, that's we need to improve all.
On July 7th, East Timor will hold parliamentary elections. The focus has been predominantly on the race to grow the economy. But with so many young voters, it's likely policies on education will help determine the outcome.
And with that, we've come to the end of this edition of Focus Asia Pacific. If you wish to listen to this program again, I invite you to check out our website at www.pcjmedia.com/FAP. Once again, that's www.pcjmedia.com/FAP. If you'd like to let us know what you think of the program, do send us an email with your comments or suggestions for stories. Our email address is pcj@pcjmedia.com. Once again, pcj@pcjmedia.com. Anyway, that's it. That's all we have time for. I have to leave you, but we'll be back in 7 days for another edition of Focus Asia Pacific, putting the focus on the Asia Pacific. So on behalf of the whole team, I'm Keith Powell, wishing you well. See you all again very soon. Bye-bye, everyone.
This is PCJ Radio on 88.2 FM. This is PCJ Radio on 107.5 FM in Nairobi, Kenya. And nationwide on 5. This is PCJ Radio on KBCT in Waco, Texas. This is PCJ Radio on 9955 kHz to Latin America. This is PCJ Radio on 7590 kHz DRM. On shortwave, satellite, and the internet. This is PCJ Radio.